And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when there are serious, serious problems in the world at large. Anybody concerned at all about the ongoing genocide? No, not in Gaza. I'm talking about Sudan, which is a big nation where there are an estimated 20 million people who are on the point of starvation. I mean, this is a terrible civil war. It is devastating the population, and nobody's doing anything about it because there's a preoccupation with Trump's hush money for porn stars trial, which second day of jury selection today, one juror sparked a smile from the former president when he said he had read some of Trump's books, including The Art of the Deal and How to Get Rich. That juror wasn't accepted. Nobody's been accepted. They've been going through this entire analysis of who is going to be on the jury, who is going to be open-minded enough and fair-minded enough to listen, actually listen to the presentation of evidence and to the legal arguments, and how many people already have strong feelings about Donald Trump, either positive or negative, that would make them ineligible to do a good job with the jury. Trump said something to the jury out loud. It got a very angry response from Judge Mershon. It looks more and more like Trump is going to be sanctioned for contempt of court for ignoring some of the gag orders. All this is going on. And what do we have? We have, meanwhile, the Congress of the United States busy with the very, very important ritual of impeaching Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, who will not be removed from office. There is no chance. It is a complete waste of time. It is a solemn embarrassment. And speaking of solemn embarrassments, there were hundreds of flights delayed by protesters, and incredibly obnoxious protesters who were protesting to support Hamas in the Middle East, and that interfered with air travel in Seattle, in Chicago, in New York, in San Francisco, and all over the country. What is accomplished here? And the whole idea that we are a country in some real difficulty right now, with decisions being made in the Middle East, not by America, but decisions being made by Israel. Is it going to be restraint or retribution? The Israeli idea is very strongly that it is simply unacceptable for them to allow this hostile power named Iran to send some 300 projectiles, missiles and drones and rockets, send them all to try to hit Israel and to kill Israelis. And the fact that they were shot down and they were successfully intercepted with the help of the United States and with the help of France and Britain and, yes, even Jordan and Saudi Arabia, with all of that going on, Israel still was attacked. And the idea that you would allow an attack like that to proceed with no consequences at all for the attacking power, that is largely unacceptable. It's unacceptable politically in Israel. The one thing that would be, it seems to me, most constructive for the Biden administration, and I'm surprised that people have not pushed on this, we're going to be talking to former ambassador from Israel to the United States, Michael Oren, coming up, and also Ilan Berman about this issue. What could Israel do without leading to an escalation to a wider war? It seems to me one of the things that Israel could do is to work with its allies, which is a tremendously important assignment, especially when you're a country of 10 million and you're dealing with 80 million Iranians. and to massive major countries, powers like the United States, which are 330 million people. In other words, to allow cooperation to have some economic consequences, some sanctions, some kind of a very clear demarcation. It's not going to work in the UN Security Council because any kind of criticism of Iran will be vetoed by Russia and perhaps by China, and they both have the veto. So forget the United Nations for a moment, but if NATO and the United States and her allies were to initiate and to restore some more of those sanctions that did serious damage to the Iranian economy, that would be a very clear message and a very clear deterrence, it seems to me, to Iran, and perhaps more clear and more functional than attacking some facility within Iran and then leading to another Iranian attack, maybe from their allies in Hezbollah with its reputed 150,000 rockets just waiting to be sent into Israel. It's all a scary thought. My brother, not my brother who already lives in Israel, who is there at home, but my brother who lives in Southern California, I spoke to last night, and is planning to go to Israel for the Passover holiday to spend it with our brother Jonathan. But it's just an unbelievable situation when you are talking about with people that you love and you care about a lot. Okay, is it safe for me to take the family there and to go there? And Jerusalem could be a target. There's also speculation now about some of those missiles that were shot down that might well have landed close to Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is supposed to be the sacred territory for Iran. And can you imagine what would happen if one of the Iranian missiles or rockets or the drone attacks actually ended up hitting the Al-Aqsa Mosque? The entire fixation with Al-Aqsa, the attack by Hamas was called the Al-Aqsa Flood, and where they were going to be attempting to flood Israel with enough terrorists to destroy the Jewish state. That hasn't worked either. And now the question is, will they move forward with, there's a report which we will come up with about the about how the IDF has decided, I don't know if this is verified yet, that the IDF has decided, according to the Jerusalem Post, the method of Iran counterstrike. And this actually at a time when a counterstrike has already occurred. What is it? What will be the impact? We will get to that talking with Michael Oren, a former member of Knesset of Israel's parliament, a very powerful parliament. There are just 120 members. And he was also, Michael Oren, Israel's very successful ambassador to the United States. He's also a leading historian of Israel's record in warfare in the Six-Day War and elsewhere. We will be speaking with Michael Oren coming up on the Michael Medved Show. Later in the show, we'll be speaking to Ilan Berman about Israel's need for a new reset of its entire matter. We'll also keep you up to date on the exciting news about the Mayorkas impeachment. Oh, heaven help us. We'll be right back.
The Michael Medved Show.
Minutes ago, there was a post at the Jerusalem Post website that announced that the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, have assassinated a senior Hezbollah coastal commander, According to the IDF, Ismail Yusuf Baz had served for decades with Hezbollah in a variety of posts before becoming a coastal commander. Michael Oren has joined us from Israel, where it's the middle of the night and where the entire nation is struggling with the decision how to retaliate, but to not exacerbate, not escalate the situation of war. Michael, a former member of parliament, a distinguished historian, best-selling author, and former ambassador of the State of Israel to the United States. Your reaction to this news about an IDF, first of all, announcing an assassination or confirming it. Generally, they're more restrained, more reluctant to make some kinds of public announcement of this sort of thing, aren't they?
Yes. Not always, sometimes. Certainly not in the aftermath of that of Iranian projectiles last Saturday night. But I've been asked repeatedly by the international press today, Michael, whether this constitutes Israel's revenge. Is this the counterstrike? And I will say categorically, it is not. This is part of our ongoing war with Hezbollah. We have been eliminating senior commanders of Hezbollah for months now, and this is just another.
Do you expect that it does not represent a definitive decision between escalation and retribution and restraint?
Well, they're not quite mutually exclusive, Michael. By mounting a counteroffensive, a serious response to Iran's outrageous aggression against us, we will be deterring them from mounting further aggression, not mounting a further escalation. It's the opposite. And the big challenge here will be to create deterrence with the Iranians without igniting sort of a wider confrontation in the Middle East, without alienating our Arab allies who proved so important to us last Saturday night, and the United States, Britain, France, others who participated in our defense. So it's going to be, we're going to be threading a very narrow needle. But as I've said repeatedly publicly, Iran is a target-rich environment, and there are many ways we can strike at Iran that would not alienate our allies, would not ignite a larger conflict, and might even help undermine the regime, which is in any case shaky.
For political reasons, perhaps, Joe Biden appears to have made the decision to be very public with his desire for Israel to, quote, take the win and to do nothing more. But American diplomats and planners and foreign policy professionals can't possibly think that Israel can go forward with just a shrug after what happened over the weekend.
No, they can't, and they don't. And I understand they're going to try to say that. Americans do not want to get dragged into a regional confrontation. And perhaps they'd like to just see us, deflect, several hundred Iranian projectiles. But you and I guess we're of a certain generation. Muhammad Ali, we remember rope-a-dope, do we not?
Oh, yes.
The younger Americans perhaps don't, but we do. What was rope-a-dope? Muhammad Ali would let the opponent just, smack him again and again in his gloves. And then when the opponent got tired, then Muhammad Ali would lash forth with his, deadly right-hand jab. You don't win a boxing match just with rope-a-dope, just by defense. You have to have the right jab. And that's what wins. And here, it's great that we were able to deflect these projectiles on Saturday night. It's a feat of technology, a feat of cooperation, strategic alliance. But it's not a win. It is a success, but not a win. The win comes when we can deter Iran from mounting further aggression against us or against other neighboring countries.
What do you think Iran was hoping to accomplish with the massive attack on Israel over the weekend?
And here we're up against a conventional wisdom that I encountered repeatedly in the international press, that Iran did this for show, that it broadcast to the United States, to Turkey, to others, that it was going to do this, that it used slow-moving drones, was sort of the spearhead, gave the United States and Israel and others time to prepare to take down. It's a lot of malarkey, Michael. You do not send 100 cruise missiles. If one of them got through, just one, could have killed thousands of people. These are huge missiles that don't take down a building, they take down a neighborhood. You don't send a message with 100 cruise missiles.
Isn't it possible one of those missiles not being precisely targeted would have struck Al-Aqsa Mosque or other sites that presumably Iran does not want to harm?
Well, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a Sunni shrine, so I don't think the Shiites care that much about it. They have blown up Sunni shrines throughout the entire Middle East. But it was curious that the White House put a statement saying how the U.S. armed forces, together with those in Israel and other allied forces, had taken down Iranian jets that were targeting Israeli military bases. To the best of my knowledge, the Dome of the Rock is not an Israeli military base.
No, not yet. Do you believe, as many people have expressed in the United States, that the most effective responses from Israel demand a change in leadership?
At best response to in Iran, yes, certainly. And I think people should stop calling for regime change in Israel, and you know who I'm talking about here, and start focusing on regime change to the true source of instability and violence and war in the Middle East, and that's Iran.
There would be a change in leadership. Isn't the Ayatollah Khamenei, isn't he like 88?
Oh, yeah, he could go, but there'd be another Ayatollah in his place. You're still left with the same regime. You're still left with the Revolutionary Guards. You're still left with the whole rotten jihadist infrastructure there. And that's what has to go. And I think that the majority of go. And so in our response, we don't want to create a situation in any way that would cause the Iranian people to rally around their government. We want them to be further strengthened in their opposition to the government.
That is Clarity, and that's actually the name of Michael Oren's Substack, Clarity with Michael Oren .substack.com, a great source of inside and important information concerning the Middle East. Sleep well, Godspeed, and Chag Kasher V'Sameach. You should have a happy and kosher Passover holiday coming up. We'll be right back. And on the Michael Medved show, there is news from Lower Manhattan and the courtroom where Donald Trump is present. And he appeared to fall asleep again today. And they describe him falling asleep as the head, which that large leonine head sort of droops and the chin goes underneath and the eyes close. Can't blame him, frankly, but they apparently, this is exciting news, they have cleared for the trial. And this literally just happened moments ago. Three jurors who seem to be acceptable. We don't know who they are. They're going to remain anonymous. There is a great concern by Judge Juan Merchan, and it's an appropriate concern. And wherever you are on this question of Trump or his political future or his guilt or his innocence of the charges against him in this and his other trials, there does need to be care on the part of any judge to prevent the intimidation of witnesses or members of the jury to keep things operating under a normal judicial standard of operation. and standard of justice. Three jurors, there are going to end up seating 12. It's unclear when they will be done with that. And then they also have to select six alternate jurors in case something happens to any of the other jurors to disqualify them, or they have a health problem or some kind of emergency that takes them out of the jury. The alternates need to be ready, watching the whole trial, taking it all in, and prepared to substitute as needed. There's, meanwhile, a question about the impact politically in the United States and on the Middle East by all of the Palestinian, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas demonstrators who have been disrupting plane travel for hundreds, actually thousands, actually it's tens of thousands now, passengers who are trying to get somewhere, and they may have been trying to get somewhere important to them. President Trump has been extremely upset because apparently he is going to have to be in the courtroom rather than attending his son Barron's high school graduation from the exclusive and very expensive prep school that that he attends. And no, President Trump can't be there for his son's graduation. But there's also questions about the jurors once they are seated. And some of those jurors likely will be Jewish. And we have the Passover holiday coming up, which for most Jewish people, except for people in the state of Israel, it's a two-day holiday at the beginning and a two-day holiday at the end. In Israel, for very complicated reasons, it is a one-day holiday. But that's not something that the court has to decide. One of the reports, and this is from King 5, it's the audio at the very top, Jeremy, they described that hundreds of flights were delayed and 46 protesters ended up being arrested for trying to shut down the SeaTac airport and make it impossible for people to make it to their flights. Part of what they were doing was blocking the drop-off that you would get if you were a passenger. And some people rushed to make their flights by carrying their baggage and actually having to travel for some substantial distance to get on board. This is a report from King 5 TV.
For a little more than 3 hours, protesters demanding the U.S. stop sending money and weapons to Israel blocked the entrance into SeaTac. They laid on the ground, bound together in white suits covered in red paint, trying to get their message across.
Stop the bombs.
Dana Sherholz came to document this protest, which backed up traffic and disrupted travel plans for countless people.
I know it makes so many people really mad, and I talked to a couple people who were mad, and I also talked to a couple people that got out of their cars and were saying, we support the cause.
Port of Seattle police arrested 46 people. A police spokesman said the protesters will likely face some sort of disorderly conduct charge. Even after arrests were made,
I'm just here to pick up my wife and my niece.
Delays continued.
They can't even get out here, and there's no way to get into the airport.
As we interviewed this man named Casey, there to pick up loved ones, another man named Mohammed, a rideshare driver, interrupted.
We can't just say, oh no.
Their conversation is one many Americans are having.
So how does this solve?
It doesn't solve nothing. It doesn't solve nothing.
So then they can get off the road and let people.
The thing is to disrupt.
The two men went back and forth for around 5 minutes, debating the impact of this protest and the reasons behind it. In the end, they agreed to disagree.
Okay, great. This is a terrific accomplishment. I mean, this is so bizarre. And look, there's a United States senator who has said Americans need to take matters into their own hands to stop those pro-Palestinian protesters. First, let's hear, there's a smartphone video that was taken by somebody stuck in traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge as the anti-Israel pro-Hamas protesters blocked the bridge for nearly 5 hours. This is in San Francisco, of course. Listen, clip 8.
Our car was stranded. Cops are backed up all the way across the bridge now.
Go ahead and get back in your car. We're going to open it up very soon.
Hey, you get out of the car!
You're being sent
in the road! You understand? You think I care? You're in the road!
Okay, again, we have enough tension and disagreement here in the United States. This is Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas on the news, urging Americans to take matters into their own hands. Clip 7.
Feel very deeply for all those people who are trying to get to work or trying to pick up a kid. Very worried about the diversion of police resources when it needs to be stopping crime in cities like San Francisco, where firefighters are having to go there when they might have calls for fires out. I have to say, Sandra, I agree with you that you have to get to these criminals early. If something like this happened in Arkansas on a bridge there, let's just say I think there'd be a lot of very wet criminals that have been tossed overboard, not by law enforcement, but by the people whose road they're blocking. If they glued their hands to a car or the pavement, well, probably pretty painful to have their skin ripped off. But I think that's the way we'd handle it in Arkansas. And I would encourage most people anywhere that get stuck behind criminals like this who are trying to block traffic to take matters in their own hands. There's only usually a few of them, and there's a lot of people being inconvenienced. It's time to put an end to this nonsense.
He has drawn a certain amount of criticism and controversy in that regard. I mean, I think particularly the detail of people gluing their hands to various places. But the entire idea that we're in a country where the numbers are so small here. These are not massive demonstrations. I know that some of the anti-war demonstrations during the Vietnam War drew 500,000 people. The mobilization that drew people to Washington, D.C. in 1970, that was 500,000 people. And that's huge. But here you're talking about 46 people shutting down airports and major airports. It's appalling, and truly something has to be done about it. Historical perspective of the Trump trials and some of the changes in the American electorate reported by Pew Research, where actually some progress for the GOP, but it may be temporary. We'll get to what that means coming up on the Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, there's a huge article in the New York Times about how the GOP, the Republicans, have closed party identification gap, a report says. This is a report that they have received from the Pew Research Center, which is one of the most authoritative sources of political information and analysis. And the New York Times summarizes the conclusions of this report. In the run-up to the 2020 election, more voters across the country identified as Democrats than Republicans. And, of course, the Democrats ended up winning the 2020 elections, despite the fact that there is still a substantial number of people who believe that they didn't actually win, that the election was stolen. But let's put that aside for a moment. Democrats won in 2020. President Biden won nationally in popular vote by 7 million votes. It wasn't a close election. Biden got higher percentages than people prior successful Democratic candidates and higher percentages than past Republican candidates. It was higher than George W. Bush. It was the only Republican in a generation, who has actually won the popular vote. But 4 years into Joseph R. Biden's presidency, that gap has shrunk, the gap between Republicans and Democrats, with Democrats having more. The gap has shrunk, and the United States now sits almost evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. Now, that doesn't mean that voting preference hasn't shifted. It's different groups now who make up the Republican coalition as opposed to the Democratic coalition. Republicans have made significant gains among all voters without college degrees, rural voters, white evangelical voters. That according to a new report from the Pew Research Center. At the same time, Democrats have held onto key constituencies such as black voters and younger voters, and have gained ground, and significant ground, with college-educated voters. The Democratic parties and Republican parties have always been very different demographically, but now they are more different than ever, said Carol Daugherty, who's director of political research at Pew. The implications of the trend, which has also shown up in party registration data among newly registered voters, remains uncertain, as a voter's party affiliation does not always predict who he or she will choose in an election. For instance, there are a significant number of Republican voters, and you can see this with the votes that went in Republican primaries to Nikki Haley after she withdrew as a candidate. You're talking about, people are estimating, up to 10% of Republicans who will not vote for Donald Trump. And so what we're talking about here is party identification, which doesn't always mean 100%, though it makes it much more likely that someone who identifies as a Republican will vote for Trump. Here's the difficulty that you take a look at when you look at this summary that says that Republicans have been gaining with rural voters. They have been gaining with voters, particularly white voters, but all voters without college degrees. And that they have been gaining with the evangelical Christian voters. And that has been going on for a while. Here's the difficulty. When you look at the demographic future, is the percentage of American evangelical Christians growing or is it shrinking? When it comes to people without a college degree, are more people getting college degrees? Yes, they are. And the percentage of people with degrees as opposed to people without degrees, that has shifted, so it's now not 2-1 in favor of non-degree people. It's much closer to even. And rural voters, it's well known, the rural population in the United States has not been increasing. So in any event, the GOP has made progress and now is basically tied with Democrats for national identification. But they are basing that on progress with groups that are not growing and that look like, as in the future, there are going to be fewer and fewer of those folks. The GOP, they write in this New York Times summary, the GOP has long struggled with the fact that there have generally been fewer Americans who identified as Republicans than as Democrats. After Barack Obama was reelected as president in 2012, the Republican Party produced a report that concluded that to be successful in future elections, the party would need to widen its tent to include black and Hispanic voters who are not traditionally involved, aligned with the GOP. Actually, in before Franklin Roosevelt, before the 1930s, the GOP was the candidate, was the party for black people who were overwhelmingly pro-Republican because that was the party that supported abolition of slavery And what changed during the war was partially the movement of the mass of black people from the South. It used to be that the people in the South who were coping with Jim Crow and segregation that was imposed by local Democratic Party officials, and those people began to move after World War I. And you had what's called the Great Migration. And when the Great Migration occurred, people ended up getting caught up in Democratic-leaning areas where there were political machines who then catered to black voters who before then had looked irrelevant to most northern, people in the South. The idea then also what changed was 1964 was an election where over 90% and the first one of black voters went to the Democrats, and that was partially because the Republicans nominated Barry Goldwater, who had been one of the very few Republicans who had voted against the Civil Rights Bill, which was considered, that was the whole purpose of Dr. King's famous March on Washington, where he delivered the I Have a Dream speech, was at least in part the purpose was to give Congress a push to pass the Civil Rights Bill, which they ultimately did, but without the support of the Republican nominee. And ironically, there was stronger support from Republicans for that bill altogether, not including Goldwater, than for Democrats. In any event, they point out that after that 2012 postmortem, where they talked about the need to change the GOP, 12 years later, the party has made small gains with Hispanic voters, but its growth with the white working class and with rural voters, that's what has propelled Republicans to equity with Democrats. The catch is that white working class voters are slowly declining as a share of registered voters. So the Republican strategy of relying heavily on the group may not be sustainable in the long term. Republicans' growing strength with white working class voters, that, they say, represents one of the biggest political schisms in the country over the past 15 years. In the 1990s and early 2000s, Democrats had a slight partisan identification advantage among voters without a college degree, while college-educated voters were more evenly divided. Now it has shifted and the differences have intensified. Coming up on the Michael Medved Show, we're going to be speaking to Ilan Berman, who's Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington. He has a provocative piece about how the Iranian-Israeli Cold War is turning hot. That's in the national interest. The question for Ilan Berman and to all of us and to policymakers is what can be done to respond without risking escalation of a wider and even more destructive war that could involve this greatest nation on God's green earth.